You ready?
Showtime.
On May 3rd, summer starts with the Fall Guy.
Let's do it later.
Let's drink a spicy margarita.
Make some bad decisions.
Yes!
Audiences are falling in love with the most entertaining film of the year.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy?
Fall Guy.
That's what the poster said.
See Ryan Gosling and Emily Blunt in the movie critics say exists to make you happy.
Trying to make it out?
Nope.
Because I don't either. It's not what I'm into right now.
What are you into?
Talking.
Yeah.
The Fall Guy. Only in theaters May 3rd. Rated PG-13.
Hello and welcome to The Metrospective, presented by Topps. Check out Topps Project 70, celebrating 70 years of Topps baseball cards. I'm Ted Berg, joined, as always, in Zoom conference by The Athletic's Mets beat writer, Tim Britton. And Tim, the Mets are not playing well. I don't know if I'm the one breaking this information to you, but the Mets have not been playing well. The Mets are now in third place after sitting in first place for the overwhelming majority of the season. And people are demanding a sacrifice. Is Luis Rojas safe? Is Zach Scott safe? Is Sandy Alderson safe?
I don't know if we're safe. I thought you brought a lot of energy to that intro. I wasn't sure if you would be as chipper as you sound. You came across certainly more chipper than the Mets did in their 1-6 road trip to Miami and Philadelphia that has dropped.
I keep it balanced, right? Like, I find there's good in this life still, even if it's not the Mets.
Yeah, you know, smile. As Pete Alonso said. I don't think we're going to have a lot of firings in the next couple of weeks.
Why not?
Thank you for interrupting that quickly. It would be like you've got in Luis Rojas, you've got, let's take it one by one. Let's start at the top with Sandy Alderson. That's not something that's going to happen in season. That is, perhaps
team,
there is a
team president. Yeah.
There's a reevaluation of the team president. At the end of the season, obviously the off season last year did not go according to plan on numerous levels. They didn't hire the president of baseball operations that they expected to. They didn't hire the GM they expected to. Well, they hired a GM and then had to fire him. So they're really, they're working with an acting GM who would have been third on their hierarchy had the offseason gone according to the initial plan that Steve Cohen and Sandy Alderson had. There was the Porter firing, the Callaway news, other news about how the front office was run in the past, including under Alderson, that was not positive. And in general, none of those things have gone well in terms of overhauling the culture. That is a years-long process. It did not get off to a good start. Zach Scott is still the acting general manager. The Mets still like him and as an executive. They haven't named him the general manager yet. I don't know if that is something that you presume is going to happen this offseason.
I'm a little surprised. It's weird. Like, why are we still bother with the acting? Is it a matter of like money? Is he not getting paid as a general manager? Because it seems strange to just like have that tag, even if he's not going to stay the general manager past this season. It's very strange to leave that acting tag on for so long.
I don't know the dynamics that go into acting versus interim versus actual general manager. But it is strange that he has been the acting GM for 6.5 months now.
He's not acting like a good GM.
but I think there's going to be a reevaluation of the entire front office structure this winter. While I would say like my expectation is probably that Alderson and Scott are still part of it going forward, I can't rule out the possibility of Steve Cohen doing something differently or looking at, who is, I brought in Alderson as a team president to get me a good president of baseball ops. That didn't work. Maybe there's someone else who could do that, someone else who wants a larger role. With Luis Rojas, he's not under contract beyond this season. I think if this team finishes in third and just kind of sputters along, goes 81-81, I think it would be the Mets would probably make a change there, I don't think that's something that happens again in season. They don't have like a set person to step up and take on that role. Dave Jouse is the bench coach. I don't think is a guy, he's a guy who doesn't have any managerial experience. I don't trying to think. I don't think anyone on there. I mean, he did. He did. Managerial experience.
It was Dave Jouse who put James McCann in that pinch hitting opportunity that won that game. Remember, that was like the biggest game of the year. McCann pinch hitting for Nito, who Nito was in there for his bat, and McCann pinch hit under. And we don't know if Rojas was really maybe calling the shots from somewhere deep in the clubhouse tunnel. But I will credit Dave Jouse with at least one game's worth of pretty good managerial experience.
Yeah, so I don't expect them to be making a change in season with Rojas, although, you know, like the fact that he's had to manage the entire year as a lame duck, you know, most managers do not get put through that, suggests that they you know, are evaluating him actively. So it wouldn't surprise me if there's a change made there in the offseason if things continue as they're going on. As for me and you, I'm not sure how the producers are evaluating us. Hopefully we're still in this role by the end of the week, but I don't know.
Yeah, it's a, you know, everything's day to day. We're all day to day. With Rojas, you know, like it's I understand that it is like a century old baseball tradition to fire the manager because you can't fire the players, but it's so hard to figure out how this could be and it's not like every button he's pushed has been the right one, but it also feels like I think a lot of people expect a manager to be turning over tables and all this other like sort of old school Leo Durocher stuff. And that's not the game today, you know? And so it's weird to me to say like, oh, Rojas has got to go because I can't feel confident about that. Like, this is the same guy who, when they hired him, everybody's talking about how impressive he was, what a great relationship he had with so many of these players from coming up through the system. He wasn't, as we know, he wasn't their first choice for manager, but a guy who was undoubtedly an up and comer. And he's a guy, you know, he's so young that it's so easy to imagine the Mets. And this will reveal something, I guess, about every Mets fan's inherent paranoia, but it's so easy to imagine like Luis Rojas parts ways with the Mets. He wouldn't even have to get fired if he's not under contract and lands somewhere else where he becomes like that team's extremely successful manager for the next 15 years.
Well, I mean, Ted, if this team had Wally Backman managing them, they'd be ahead of the Giants.
They'd be right running through brick walls,
it's always hard to judge a manager, like how good a manager is. As a beat writer, I've always found that one of the more difficult things to do. It's especially hard now because we're not in the clubhouse, so you don't get a sense for how the team feels about the manager. Because, you know, if you ask a player on a Zoom conference how he feels about the manager, you're going to get a certain kind of answer.
You're not
going to
get one of those, like, telling eye rolls you sometimes get amid, like, a quote that says nothing, but, like, you can tell from the body language what this means.
Right. There's no way to go up after and have a smaller on background conversation about how they really feel. So I think the sense that I still get in so much as you can get one is that the players do like Rojas and that he gets the most out of them. I think we're going to get a sense of the post game on Sunday did not strike the right chord from either Rojas or Alonso for that matter. In the kind of like, you know, we're hitting the ball hard, we're right there. And it's fine for them to say that to the public.
It's like shades of the Tom Glavine, I'm not devastated thing, where it's like, of course, he shouldn't be devastated. But as a fan, I'm devastated. And like, I kind of want you to be respectful of that.
Right. You know, it's fine if they're saying that out, you know, it's not going to win you a lot of fans at a time like this. But you would hope kind of behind closed doors that they are expressing it with a little bit more dismay that this isn't, you know, 1 week of them hitting into some bad luck. It's tough to say we're stinging the ball. We feel really good about it. When you hit five balls out of the infield in 30 plate appearances, you make 22 outs that are on the ground, pop-ups or strikeouts in a game. As the Mets did on Sunday. So you hope behind the scenes it's a little bit more urgent because it's not just like, I think under normal circumstances, if you have a stretch like this at this time of year, you say, okay, you've got a series coming up against Washington, you get back into it. But that schedule coming up with LA and San Francisco for 2 weeks without Jacob deGrom for that stretch, likely without Francisco Lindor for most, if not all of that stretch. We don't know if you're going to have Javi Baez now for all of that stretch. You just went 1-6 on the road in Miami and Philly. What are you going to do in seven games in San Francisco and LA? You know, you can look at that 13-game stretch, and had the Mets had that four-game lead going into it, you'd say, okay, you can survive going 5-8, and you'd be okay. If you're four games back and you go 3-10, you're in a world of trouble there, and it's already late August at that point. So I think we're going to get a sense of how much Luis Rojas' even-keel approach plays in the clubhouse at a time of real crisis during a baseball season, and how the team responds to, you know, they've responded well to adversity within games earlier in the season. Within the season, you know, after that series in Tampa where they got swept and they lost McNeil and Conforto the last day, they came back and had a nice stretch for the 2 weeks after that. We're going to see how they can handle this one, because this is when you need to be at your best as a team and as a manager, and we'll get a better sense of where the Mets are in the next couple of weeks.
Yeah, I think that's fair. I think just to go back, you mentioned Sunday's game and the offense. I would say that one doesn't bother me as much as the rest of the week, if only because, and this doesn't even bother me. I'm sure it bothers some Mets fans, because it came against Zach Wheeler, and Wheeler has got to be at this point the Cy Young favorite in the National League. And I don't know if this is because I met Zach Wheeler a bunch of times and always found him a pretty pleasant guy, but like, I have no Met fan angst about Wheeler being awesome this year. Like, I'm full on happy for him.
Yeah, I mean, I think it makes you more angry at the Mets,
right?
Because I think there was a section of the fan base that was like, good riddance, this guy had a 100 ERA plus over his career.
But all the signs were there. All the signs were there.
But yeah, I think if you watched him, like, I feel good, because in like June of 2018, I was like, you know, I think Zach Wheeler's really, really doing something here, really turning it around, even though the ERA didn't suggest as much. And here we are a couple of years later, and he might not be the best pitcher in the National League on a per inning basis, but he's so far ahead of a lot of other guys. You know, he's pitched 43 more innings than Corbin Burns. I'm looking at the Fangraph stats. I would probably say Wheeler and Walker Buehler are probably the two guys that you'd put at the head of the list for the NL Cy Young. And the Mets will presumably get to see Buehler at least once in the next couple weeks.
Yeah, and this West Coast trip, which you mentioned, coming against the class of the National League, the defending champion Dodgers in there, teams that I think present, you know, models, as we've discussed in the past, models for what you want the Mets to be like. And so, you know, on one hand, maybe they show some pluck and compete against these teams. Or on the other, maybe we all get a sense of the distinction between your third place, very middling Mets roster and, you know, what a bona fide World Series contender looks like.
Yeah, and look, the Phillies have the Dodgers first this week. LA starts that road trip in Philadelphia on Tuesday. And then they get the Reds over the weekend, who are playing really good as well. Can't lose the grammar here. So, you know, you get a sense of Philadelphia built its winning streak against the Mets and the Nationals, teams that are not playing well or good. And so, you know, we'll see how those teams, how Philly does against those teams. Then you see how the Mets do against those teams. Against LA at least, and kind of compare them and juxtapose it for the next 2 months. You know, there is a sense, like, it's very easy in the moment right now to think the season is over, that 2.5 games is too much, the way Philadelphia is playing. But I still, like, Atlanta might be the team you're more worried about in the East, because they've kind of put it together as well, and now they're ahead of the Mets too. They're a half game ahead of New York at the moment as we're recording this Monday. You know, the Phillies might be peaking too early. They have kind of that feel to them a little bit. But the Braves are a team that's also right there. And it's just, it's a lot harder to figure out exactly how the Mets are going to be in a good spot on whenever that 2 week stretch ends. So August 27th or so, moving forward in the NL East.
It kind of feels like the Mets peaked too early, and like their peak just wasn't very high.
Yeah, the 17-9 May, where they had a 7-game winning streak, a 5-game winning streak. They've been basically a mediocre team every other point of the season. So they'll have to try to find, you know, I've been waiting for them. You know, we thought when everyone came back healthy at the beginning of July, like, this is where they can go on their run. They had that 7-game stretch around the All-Star break against Pittsburgh, you thought if you go 6-1 there, you really build a cushion. Like if they go 6-1 in that stretch instead of 3-4, their trade deadline day lead in the NL East is 7 and not 4. And I don't, you know, if you're the Phillies and you're 7.5 back because they were an additional half game behind Atlanta, are you making the Kyle Gibson trade? You know, are you doing things the same way that you did? And the Mets, they missed out on the opportunity to really bury those teams, including Atlanta with that 5-game series right before the break, right before the deadline. And they've let those teams stay in it long enough to make the improvements that they needed to make. And now they've kind of leapfrogged the Mets.
Can we get Brandon Drury some more at bats while he's still hot? Like, is it crazy to say, like, maybe there needs to be just even if it's not like a permanent thing, but just like shake up who's playing a little bit to try to jar something loose in this offense?
I mean, we saw that Saturday, right? That yeah. Where they went with the right-handed lineup against Ranger Suarez. And I thought that I liked parts of that idea, but I didn't love the complete execution of it. I would have switched the lineup more aggressively. I would have had, like, you know, they pinch hit Conforto for Drury in the fourth inning. I would have pinch hit Dom Smith for Kevin Pillar in the fifth when the right-hander was in there, just to give those guys more of a platoon advantage. So we've seen them try to mix things up. I don't think that's something they would have done 3 weeks ago if they were facing Ranger Suarez in the same circumstances. But because of the way the team had hit, they tried something different, and that also did not work.
Yeah, I'm glad you brought up Pillar because, like, it's, and I hate to, like, everybody's, no one's hitting, right? So you hate to single out guys. We know Pillar seems like everybody really likes him. He had the cool thing where he got hit in the face and he came back then and wanted to play the next day. Like, I get that he's a popular guy in the clubhouse. Since the start of July, Pillar has a 4.23 OPS, and I feel like every time I turn around, he's a bat.
Yeah, it's been really outside of the big home run he hit in Cincinnati in that 15-11 game. It's been a tough stretch for him since the All-Star break, maybe even a little earlier than that, that he just hasn't been able, you know, since he basically went back to part-time play, it's been really hard for him to find his offensive rhythm again. And, you know, that was kind of the case with a lot of those part-time players. Was it wasn't like they were posting 850 OPSs. The OPS for Kevin Pillar was never that high. It was you know, maybe right around 700 at its peak. Jose Peraza, it was never high, but they seemed to come up big when they needed them to, late in games or off the bench. And now they're not getting those contributions.
I bite your tongue.
Not just from the bench guys, but from anyone.
Bite your tongue. Jose Peraza is out with an injury, right? He is still, as far as I'm concerned, he is still the most clutch guy in the world. He's just, I think that you can maybe chalk up this little losing streak here to the absence of Jose Peraza and his 600 OPS or whatever it is.
Yeah, you know, the shine has not dulled on him quite yet. There is still the chance that he comes back and leads them to the NL East championship.
And now, two pigeons bemoaning the fact you can stream DirecTV satellite-free.
Hey, Frank, a little birdie told me you don't need a satellite dish to get DirecTV.
What's little birdie?
Was it Jimmy the Sparrow?
It's a figure of speech. Point is, you can stream DirecTV over the internet now.
Oh, sure. Next you're going to tell me those big birds are made of metal and filled with people, right?
You mean airplanes?
Stream DirecTV without a satellite dish. Call 1-800-DIRECTV. Terms or restrictions apply.
Hey, it's Kaylee Cuoco for Priceline. Ready to go to your happy place for a happy price? Well, why didn't you say so? Just download the Priceline app right now and save up to 60% on hotels. So whether it's Cousin Kevin's Kazoo Concert in Kansas City, go Kevin! Or Becky's Bachelorette Bash in Bermuda, you never have to miss a trip ever again. So download the Priceline app today. Your savings are waiting.
Go to your happy place for a happy price. Go to your happy price, Priceline.
We have a couple of questions. You mentioned grammar. And so I want to, before we have a really good question from Matt, which is not to dismiss Adam's really good question. It's just Adam sent in a question that is not based on the Mets' current disappointing, perhaps existential performance. Adam just wants to know, he says, I have a grammatical question for a couple professional writers. Questionable on my case. Is it grammatically correct to say, I'm watching the Met game, or should it be, I'm watching the Mets game? In which case, should Mets be possessive plural, I'm watching the Mets apostrophe game?
So, you know,
this is a style guide question, really.
To me, all three are fine. If I were writing it, I would probably go with Metz, not possessive. Mm-hmm. And the, I always try to, whenever I run into that, I'm never sure exactly. If I'm unsure of it, I'll use the magic, because that's a singular word. You know, if I'm trying to say like, oh, the Mets pitching has been bad lately. Like, right. What would I say if it were the magic? It'd be the magic's pitching has been bad. Okay, use the apostrophe. Yeah. In that case, I think because it works both singular and plural, that it you can go either way. Like, you're watching the Magic game or the Magic's game. They're both fine. So I think it works possessive and non-possessive.
You would say you're watching the Magic's game? You wouldn't say that.
I don't think colloquially you would say that, but I think it would make grammatical sense.
Yeah, it would. It would. I say, for me, I would say, yeah, the Mets game, no possessive. But if I was saying like the Mets right fielder who is 1-for-15 and is less or whatever, then that's clearly a possessive. I would, my bone to pick with the issue, or I guess, and I say, again, I say the Mets game. But I feel like no one would ever say I'm watching the Yankees game. Everybody's just like, I'm watching the Yankee game. And so, again, it's like a colloquial thing. But it sometimes it's got to be a touch and feel thing for me.
Yeah, it works, you know, differently for different franchises and just the way it sounds, you know. Like, it's easier probably to say the Magic's game than like the Jazz's game. That's just too many. Consonants there. So I think in general I'd be like, oh, I'm gonna watch the Mets game later. That's probably how I would say it.
Yeah, and you would be correct. So I think to answer Adam's question, we go with Mets, we go with watching the Mets game, but no possessive.
And one of the things that, so I, you know, as I've mentioned at least once a podcast, I think I used to cover the Red Sox, and that was grammatically difficult because,
oh, impossible.
You know, you'd have Sox, and like I feel like the style that most other people who covered them went with was SOX apostrophe, mm-hmm. no S for when you were using Red Sox.
That's what that's what I always went with.
And I always hated that. So I would put the S. I would, you know, in all those cases, I would always try to just do Boston's.
Right.
Try to work the story around so I could say Boston's. And then also, you know, you would have, if like you're talking about an individual player, like, you know, the way you would talk about an individual Met, he's been the Met that's hit the best lately.
This is the issue,
And you'd say you would say, like, if I were pronouncing it to you, I'd say he's the Red Sox who has hit the best, but you still spell it SOX. That is how it was explained to me, according to, I guess, Providence Journal style.
Yeah, for me, it's always just right around it. Like, he has been the best hitting player on the Red Sox, or he is the Boston player who has been hitting the best.
Yeah, it there's like an instance or two per season where you're like, I can't get around this. I got to go with it.
He's a Red Sox. Yeah, it's very strange. You know, don't, it's not that, yeah, whatever. I'm not going to bring up why the Red Sox are named that. It's something they get away with just because they always have. Right? You're Red Sox with an X. Like, that's just a weird, if a new team started and there were no Red Sox and no White Sox and some new team just exist, like we're going to be the Portland Blue Sox and we're spelling it with an X. We'd be like, that is the lamest thing I have ever heard in my entire life.
I mean, that's true of so many team names.
That's
like
true.
The Knickerbockers, right. the Philadelphia, I mean, the Mets lost their weekend series to the Philadelphia Philadelphians.
Right. I mean, the Mets itself is not like, you know, it's, there's nothing, I don't know. There's nothing especially compelling about the name Mets.
I love the brief period in Philly's history where they like attempted to also be the Blue Jays and then gave up on it very quickly.
It wasn't going to work. You're the Phillies. We also have several questions. So we also got a bunch of questions, and this is an important one. What are we going to do if the Mets really do fall out of contention? Like, are we going to just talk books on the podcast, or will we talk like past games? Because there's only so much you can be like, when is Mark Vientos coming?
Well, I mean, we have some experience with this last year, in 2020.
Speak for yourself.
When Pete and I had some guests on, and, you know, would talk about old things that happened with the Mets and what's going on currently. I mean, look, the Mets, one of the good things about covering a team like the Mets, a franchise like the Mets, is that the fan base is always so engaged that The Mets are never irrelevant. And that's true not just in if it's September 15th of a season where they're going to lose 95 games. And it's just as true in the middle of December that offseason when they're in between 95 lost seasons. Like they're always a relevant team. People always care deeply about them. And we'll always have something to talk about, even if it is just like the Mets in literature, because we can do that too. That's a podcast.
You're never more than a week away from the Mets doing something outrageously stupid. Right? So there's always something. I mean, I hosted a Mets podcast from like 2009 to 2012, right? So like I've been through the darkness and made it out with a decent podcasting routine. So we will get you through it, I would say, if you're wondering about that. But yeah, we may have to fall back on different things besides like, hey, how are the Mets going to stay in contention if they don't stay in contention? But is the season not over yet? The season's not over yet, right? There's like this is rock bottom, maybe, hopefully. And maybe things can turn around. I still think the offense should be better, but Matt has a great question about why the offense is so bad. And it's something you've written about a little bit. And it's something I really don't understand all that well. It's a hard thing to make sense of. Matt writes, prior to the Phillies series, MLB.com had a story about the Mets offensive woes. And I found myself wondering if there's a weird duality of this offense, effective when not making contact, not effective when making contact. And he linked me to an article from Mike Petriello, a friend of mine, works for MLB.com. He's like their StatCast guy. And he took a pretty deep dive into the stats on the Mets offense. And a lot of the things are some of the things we talked about. He also talked quite a bit at length about the effects of Citi Field and how perhaps Citi Field suppresses offense more than we realize. But also makes this point that the Mets, he says, the Mets swing at strikes more than all but three other teams. Only one team takes fewer called strikes. I think now a couple teams have jumped ahead of them, but he says when they're taking, this is from Mike, he says when they're taking balls or strikes of any variety, they're one of baseball's most efficient offenses, meaning like that when they're playing more patiently, they're, I guess, playing better. And he says, when they contact the ball, they're ahead of only the Cardinals, Rangers, D-backs, and Pirates in terms of generating value. They have only the 24th best quality of contact. They have the fifth worst run value on that contact, sixth fewest homers, fewest extra base hits. He also points out that they're the least effective base running team in baseball, but that obviously doesn't make nearly as big of a dent as the thing with the offense, which is just a complete lack of quality contact. And Matt says, taking that together with what Hugh Quattlebaum said in Tim's Q&A last week, what Pete Alonso said Sunday about the process being good, could it be that this is actually a process issue? Is the idea of swinging at and taking the right pitches overemphasized at the expense of better quality contact, or am I reading too much into a 110-game sample? There's a lot there.
I really zoned out. Can you repeat that? I'm just going to go kind of stream of conscience, different thoughts off of the really good story that Mike had done last week. I think it's hard to get a total reading of the quality of contact because of Citi Field, because it's not just like, you know, it's not just that the Mets score fewer runs at home or they hit fewer home runs at home, all which is true. And has been true really since the inception of Citi Field. It's also that some of the more advanced things that we look at, things like barrel rate and exit velocity, those are also down at Citi Field. And Citi Field is kind of an anomaly in the way it seems to suppress exit velocity for anyone.
Could that be? So is that the batter's eye is bad or something, like, or does hitters don't see? Because you know, you can say, okay, well, Coors Field, the ball flies further because the environment is different. But why would a park suppress barrel rate?
The most compelling potential theory that I had heard was just like the way they stored the baseballs. However, they stored the baseballs wasn't great or didn't allow, you know, affected the quality of contact from 2015 to 2019. As we've talked about here, the Mets were one of the teams that installed a humidor prior to 2020 to store the baseballs in. And last year was the year where Citi Field played a little bit better for offense than it had in previous years. It was less aberrational than the other years it had been open. And this year it's kind of gone back to...
I'm sorry, how were they storing the baseballs? That would be different.
I don't know.
That would be different from the way all of the other... Like, what? How do you store baseballs if not, like, in a closet somewhere?
Maybe the room where they had it was too cold or too warm. I don't... I'm not a physics professor, Ted. I'm just telling you the theory that...
I want to know, like, what wacky Mets stuff happened to make that the case. Because like, I have no doubt that that's true, right? Like, I am 100% certain now that you have presented this theory that the Mets were doing something, like, flagrantly wrong in how they stored baseballs. I just want to know what that was.
Why did the equipment manager go into the bathroom with a sack of footballs at Gillette Stadium? Right. We'll never know, Ted. So that's the most compelling thing I've heard about that, like, about why the difference in Citi Field exists quite to the extent that it has. I think in general, you look as Mike's article pointed out, you know, even with that context, the Mets were the best slugging team on the road in 2020, and they're 16th, I believe, this year. 13th best on the road this year in terms of slugging. You know, it's one thing to say, like, maybe if they were just on the road the whole time, their slugging numbers would be better. At the same time, they come off a 1-6 road trip where they didn't score very many runs. They look pretty bad overall. Getting back to the initial question, like, should the Mets' approach be different? You know, the approach that they had, there's kind of the two different approaches that they've had in the last couple of years. First, with Pat Russler, when he was the hitting coach, was kind of the Kevin Long approach. Going back to earlier in the decade, and is more of what Hugh Quattlebaum preaches, which is swinging at the right strikes.
Mm-hmm.
There's the line. Let me look it up in the Quattlebaum story that I did the other day about the way you do well as an offense is by attacking the right pitches in the strike zone. You know, your success is going to be determined by the pitches you swing at. And the best pitches, the pitches that get driven the most, are the ones usually in the center of the zone. And so, you know, deciding what you swing at is going to determine the quality of your contact. And you're going to take your best swing all the time. Your A swing, they call it. And so, you know, we've heard Luis Rojas has talked about A swings more this year than he did last year. And, you know, that leads to some guys not cutting down their two-strike approach. They're still trying to put their best swing on it, even in an 0-2 count, for instance. And then there's more of the approach that Chili Davis preached during 2019 and 2020 with the Mets, that, you know, you wanted to adapt to the circumstances, kind of go with the pitch at times. You know, in a two-strike count, don't be afraid to hit it the other way. Use the whole field and try to hit line drives. You know, it's more about line drives through the ball than getting under the ball for fly balls and potentially home runs. And the thing is, both of those approaches work differently for different guys. Mm-hmm. There's guys that the A-swing approach is really going to resonate with. Brandon Nimmo has talked about how that resonates with him, and he's not the guy you
right.
think that would resonate with because of the way he takes pitches. But also, the Chili Davis approach really connected with Dominic Smith, a guy who got into trouble in the minor leagues when he tried to hit too many home runs and tried to be kind of your prototypical power-hitting first baseman. And when he got back to using an all-field line drive approach, really excelled in 2020. So it's got to be a mix. I don't think you can have a one-size-fits-all organizational philosophy in terms of hitting. It's got to be tailored more individually than that. I don't know what the failure is necessarily in the process. I just know, as I wrote on Monday morning, like, if, you know, Rojas has been talking for at least a week now about how they seem unprepared to hit fastballs, which
very way to be a major leaguer.
Like a weird thing
yeah.
to be unprepared for. And it's just gotten worse in the days since he brought it up. And it seems like that should not be a week-long or weeks-long thing to fix. It should be something you're able to enact a little bit quicker. So I wonder if the process could be more refined in terms of reacting and adapting to the issues that are plaguing the offense at hand. And again, it's tough to speak about it as a collective because it's really just a whole bunch of smaller individual issues expressing themselves at the same time.
Yeah, and that was one of Mike's conclusions in the MLB.com article. It was like a giant portion of the Mets' struggles is that Conforto and Lindor and to a somewhat lesser extent Dominic Smith have all so far underperformed expectations this year.
Yeah, that those guys have not been what you expect them to be, and it's for different reasons. Mm-hmm. Like Lindor was off early in the season and seemed to be, you know, basically since June 1st has been hitting much better, but then got hurt. Conforto got a slow start to spring training and then had his own injury issues. He wasn't playing well before that, but has been in more of a slump since then. Seems like he might be coming out of it in the last week. He's the guy really in the lineup that does seem to be making harder contact and hitting into some hard outs. You've got those guys. Smith is underperforming last year. I don't think it's not stunning that Dominic Smith has a 100 OPS plus or slightly below that. But you certainly thought he was going to be better than that, given the way he hit last year. And then you don't have anyone really overperforming. Like JD Davis has, but it's in a small number of at-bats because he missed so much time. Alonso is about where you'd expect him to be. McNeil is lower than you'd expect him to be, but not that much lower. He's still an above average hitter. So they don't, you know, it's not like evened out by anyone. Like Lindor and Conforto's really large struggles compared to what you would have expected haven't been mitigated by anyone going off and having like, Richard Hidalgo's 8-game run in 2004 or whatever over the course of the first four.
That is
months.
A great poll.
Is it bad that that's like my first example of a random guy on the Mets getting hot for an extended, you know, you don't have like Jose Valentin from 2006 just having a really good offensive season for you out of nowhere and becoming one of your best hitters. Like that's what you would need to happen in a situation like this to compensate for some of the other guys not coming through the way you expect.
And that's kind of the thing that is often the differentiator between a first place team and a disappointing team, right? Like, design is a huge component of building a good baseball team. That's undeniable. But every really, really good baseball team has at least one or two guys who it's like, whoa, that guy came out of nowhere.
Well, yeah, like I go back to the 2013 Red Sox, where, you know, they won the World Series, and then in 2014 they finished in last. And I remember writing for Baseball Prospectus about that and using like Mike Karp, another mm-hmm. classic name from Mets history. Yeah. As an example of like, you know, in 2013, Mike Karp was a part-time player for the Red Sox, got almost 250 plate appearances, had an 885 OPS, like came through all the time, hit a pinch hit grand slam to win a game in Tampa against the second place team in the division. Like whenever they needed someone to step up, Mike Karp was there. A year later, he was hurt a lot, like when Mike Napoli got hurt and they needed Mike Karp to fill in at first base for the next 2 weeks. Karp got hurt the next day. He hit 175. He had a 48 OPS plus. And he got DFA'd by like July or August. And that's like, you know, Mike Karp being awesome 1 year and terrible the next is the shorthand for how one season can be so charmed and one season not. And, you know, the Mets have not had a charmed season from a hitting perspective. They haven't had any of those guys. They've had some big hits from those guys, Peraza. You go back to the game in Miami in May when Jake Hager and Jhenasree Fargas and Khalil Lee like all got their first major league hits seemingly in order in extra innings or something like that to win a game. They've had individual instances like that, but they just haven't had the amassed experience of guys coming through unexpectedly while other guys you expect to come through have not.
I just pulled up, just like out of curiosity, I pulled up the White Sox baseball reference page this year. The White Sox are in first place in the AL Central, having a great year, look like they're going to make the playoffs. Some guys having like 115 or above OPS pluses for the White Sox this year include Andrew Vaughn, Brian Goodwin, Adam Engel, and then all above 100, Jake Lamb, who's been kicked around a bunch, Gavin Sheets, Sebi Zavala, not a name I've ever heard before in my entire life, is a catcher on the White Sox with a 109 OPS plus. Like, that's a team where everybody they call upon is just doing it, and like sometimes that magic just sort of hits for a team.
Sebi Zavala had a three-homer game last week. It was the first three homers of his career.
I was on vacation.
It was basically the closest thing someone had come to pulling a Nguyen Heis.
Well, that's why he has a 109 OPS plus, because of that one game. I guess if you took that out, he only has 10 hits on the year. It's a very short, small sample size. So minus those three home runs, he's probably not over 100 on the OPS plus. But the point stands, right? Like it's like I don't know. And you can say like, oh no, this is process. This is a hitting coach. This is the manager. This is the clubhouse chemistry. And maybe it's all of those things, but maybe also sometimes it's just like, hey, like everything came up White Sox this year.
Yeah. And, you know, I think we have to account for like the change in hitting coach. Like even if you prefer, as the Mets front office does, kind of the way the approach that Quattlebaum suggests over the one that Chili Davis does, making that change at that point in the season is going to be disruptive to an extent. It's going to take, especially because, you know, Quattlebaum and Kevin Howard were new to the organization this offseason. They didn't have a lot of time in spring training with these guys. That was not going to be a seamless transition. You know, when I talked to Hugh the other day, he said, you know, I asked him when he got comfortable with each guy with the team's swings, like on an individual level. And he said it was basically a few weeks ago, you know, mm-hmm. So it was, that change was made in late April. It took probably 2.5 to 3 months before he was up to speed and knew the guys as well as Chili Davis. And especially, you know, Tom Slater, the assistant hitting coach, was a guy who had been there for a few years and had worked with guys for a while. So he had a really good beat on where their swings were at. So, you know, that's, when you make the in-season changes like that, especially when they're changes kind of a philosophy and of at least vocabulary, different hitting coaches use different words right. to express the same concept, there's going to be a step back. It's going to be harder for guys who are in a slump at that point to connect with the new guy and to build on it going forward. And I think the Mets might have underrated that impact, even if they like the change for the long term.
I remember one time, I believe it was Dale Swaim was the hitting coach for the Royals, and I asked him something about like the Royals approach, and he was like, well, we got to get our dick in the dirt. And it was, what is that? Like, that is like a clay, like this, that is the type of thing that like a hitting coach says that might make sense to some of his hitters. And it's like that, I'm going to need a long translation of whatever the heck that means.
Get ready for the greatest roast of all time. The roast of Tom Brady. A Netflix live event happening May 5th, hosted by Kevin Hart. The seven-time world champion gets his cleats held to the fire by famous friends and frenemies on an unforgettable night where everything is fair game. Tune in on May 5th at 5 p.m. Pacific time for The Roast of Tom Brady, live only on Netflix.
I want to leave you with one thought, just because I want to get this in before it becomes a thing. If Rojas is not back yet next year, do you think there's any chance they revisit Carlos Beltran?
Ooh, I was ready for you to ask if they were going to revisit Bobby Valentine.
No.
Which I don't think they should.
He's making the rounds. He's on a media tour right now, but
I know. Well, he's got bigger concerns right now in Stanford.
Right.
Beltran, I mean, they could.
He's around.
Think about it. But
I mean, Alex Cora and AJ Hinchard are both managing, right? There's like, why? Right. I mean, we both know there's no reason, like there, it doesn't make any sense morally, ethically, legally or whatever to keep Carlos Beltran out of the game when basically everyone else from that Astros team is either still in baseball or welcome back in baseball, unless, you know, they've the separate, GM incident, assistant GM incident. I forget that guy's name, which is probably for the best. I don't know if, can it be Beltran, Tim?
It can be Beltran. I think, you know, you make the moral case that if the other guys are back, you can bring Beltran back. I think the thing that you think about is, so AJ Hinch and Alex Cora were not just guys with like previous major league managerial experience.
They were successful. They were,
guys who had won the World Series. You know, you might put an asterisk next to Hinch's.
You might put an asterisk next to Cora's too.
True. But I think if you had polled major league executives at the time that story came out in 2019 and asked who they thought the best managers in baseball were, those guys would probably be the names you saw the most, or at least in the top three or five. There was a wide perception that those were two of the best managers in baseball. Carlos Beltran, you know, a lot of his candidacy with the Mets initially in late 2019 was built off of the idea of his connection with his ability to connect to players, the way he would build a clubhouse culture that you liked. And you have to wonder on some level, and I remember talking about this in 2020, you know, at the time when they were letting go of Carlos Beltran, something I didn't factor in early enough when that story initially came out in November was, man, it's got to be tough to be a pitcher if Carlos Beltran is your manager, right? Like, you've got to be pretty upset about what he did with the Astros. And like, Marcus Stroman, I think, was pretty vocal about what Houston did. So I think that affects, like, his resume is not as appealing to you as a team hiring as it was in 2019 because of this. The same is true for Hinch and Cora, but kind of the pros on their resume outweighed the cons in Detroit's mind and in Boston's mind. There's still the chance that in the Mets' mind, if they were to make a managerial change, the pros on Carlos Beltran's resume outweigh this con. But I think the balance is not, it's a harder balance for him than it is for guys who had won the World Series in the dugout already.
Well, they can chalk up as another pro the fact that Metrospective co-host Ted Berg strongly endorses this idea.
And that Carlos Beltran apparently makes a delicious tres leches cake, which is something that every clubhouse could use.
Yeah, he owned a restaurant for a while. I mean, Beltran is he's a man about town. I mean, you could talk about whether or not he fostered a good clubhouse culture. Hard to come up with a better clubhouse culture than the one that successfully cheats its way to the World Series championship without anyone saying a thing. Right. So, you know, for whatever you want to say about how they got there, I wouldn't mind if for just one time the Mets could be that team that cheats its way to a championship.
You can say that. I don't know that every Mets fan agrees with you. Probably more.
They're all cheating. Everybody's cheating. They're all trying to cheat. Right. Just I want the team that cheats successfully.
That is one way to go about fandom. That's how I think most football fans feel.
Yeah, I mean, the Patriots are good with it, right? I know a lot of Patriots fans, and they all seem to sleep at night.
Yeah, I don't think that, you know, maybe not anymore with Tom in Tampa, but we'll see.
Tim, it has been real, as always. Peace out.
Adios.